I'll introduce myself first, because that will help to explain why I'm here introducing Frank. I'm the president of the Reading branch of the Historical Association. It's a great pleasure to us to have the annual conference here in Reading, and it is a great pleasure to me to be able to introduce my old friend Frank Tallett this afternoon. This is in fact the second time I have introduced a lecture by Frank within the last 6 months, because he gave an excellent lecture at the local branch of the Historical Association only a few months ago. Frank is a fellow in history at the University of Reading and formerly head of its School of Humanities. Warfare and society is one of his specialities, and if you have read your programme, as I'm sure you have, you will know that he has published extensively in that area. The lecture he gave to the Reading branch was on Napoleon's invasion of Russia. The talk he's going to give today is War, Society and the State in Early Modern Europe. And those two pieces of information will help to give you an idea of the breadth of his interests. I can assure you, from having heard him before, that he will deliver you an excellent lecture, and I'm looking forward to it. Frank.
Thank you very much indeed. Yeah. Very nice introduction. I've got no small change on me, but I'll certainly see you all right later on. Thank you. Can you all hear me? That's the first thing.
Yes.
And can you all see the slides at the minute, or would you prefer the room to be dim? It's all right?
Fine.
Could be dim slightly? Okay. Means I can't see what I'm going to read from, but hey, you know, that doesn't matter, James. What I'd like to do today is to talk very generally about war and society in the state in early modern Europe. Thank you. That is to say, roughly Europe from about 1500 to about 1789. And as many of you will know, military history has changed a very great deal in the last three or four decades. Whereas at one stage it was almost obsessively concerned with badges and buttons and tactics and strategy and battles, it's now altered, and warfare has been set very much more into its social, its institutional, and its economic context. And I think this is all to the good. What I want to do today is try and reflect this so-called new military history by talking very generally about warfare, society, and the state. So I'm going to deal with these things in very general terms. I'm going to deal mainly with armies, not because I don't think navies aren't interesting and aren't important, but we've only got a limited amount of time. And they are slightly different in some respects to armies, so I'll concentrate on armies. But if at the end of this anybody's interested in talking about navies in question time or afterwards, I'd be very pleased to do so. Let me begin today's talk by just pointing to one feature of the military history of the early modern period. And this is the very prodigious growth in the number of men who are under arms in this period. In the 16th century, the largest permanent force in anywhere in Europe was the Army of Flanders, based in the Low Countries. And that had as its core about 15,000 men. Yet by the time of the 30 Years' War in the mid-17th century, France could mobilise, albeit with difficulty, about 125,000 men. And that 30 Years' War, which goes between 1618 and 1648, saw the involvement of about a quarter of a million men. By the time of the late 17th century, the strength of the French army peaked at around 350,000, and during the War of the Spanish Succession in the early 18th century, there were about 1.4, perhaps 1.5 million men mobilised to fight this engagement. And during the 18th century, the leading powers of Europe maintained about 100,000 men in peacetime, 150,000 men in wartime. And certainly the wartime establishments in the 18th century are about four or five times bigger than they were 200 years previously. And it's worth adding, while we're dealing with numbers, that even small states, if they are to hold their own, had to maintain pretty sizable armies. So a state like Piedmont in northern Italy in 1734 fielded around 40,000 men, roughly a third of them foreigners who were employed in the Piedmontese army. So the first question we really need to resolve is, how do we explain this very prodigious growth in the number of men under arms? And what I want to suggest is that there are three principal reasons, one of which is much more important than the others, but there are three principal reasons. The first two really have to do with the changing technology of warfare. What we've got here is a picture. It's it's an Italian painting from a chest in the 15th century, showing armoured knights fighting. And in the late Middle Ages, warfare was really dominated by knights. They're heavily armoured, they're inordinately expensive to equip, their armour and their horses and so on cost a fortune. They're very difficult to train. It takes a long while to train a knight. You need to really start as a boy if you're going to get all the equine skills that you need. And also, knights are overwhelmingly drawn from the noble class. So reasons of cost and this social origin of knights means that there is really a ceiling on the number of knights you can have mobilised at any one time. And this begins to change in the really in the 15th century with what is often referred to as the infantry revolution. And it's discovered that you can actually oppose the mounted knight by the use of pikemen if they're properly organised and properly trained. And you see this in a series of engagements which probably culminate in the battles fought by Charles the Bold of Burgundy, in which the final one of which he loses his life. And you see these new types of soldiers, pikemen, being able to effectively resist the mounted knights. And these pikemen do this by holding their 12 or 14, 16 foot long pikes, grounding the butt end into the soil and pointing the projecting sharp end. You know, there's a lot of technical terms like sharp end. Hopefully we'll be there. Pointing this out, becoming a bit like a hedgehog. And then the Swiss evolve what's called the steamroller, the Swiss steamroller, whereby they're able to coordinate their movements and actually move, holding their pikes pointing out. And this turns them not just into a defensive unit, but into an offensive unit as well. Now, the key point about these pikemen is this, that they're relatively cheap to equip. This man here has got body armour and a helmet on, but really all you need is a helmet, a sword probably, and the pike, and probably a leather jacket of some kind. So for the cost of hiring one knight, you get far many more pikemen. So you get a lot more men for your money. The other thing is that pikemen, although they do need training, don't need the kind of extended training that knights required. And they can also be drawn from any social class. And indeed, the Swiss pikemen who dominate and also the German Landsknecht are largely drawn from peasant communities. So the move towards pikemen removes one restraint upon the size of armies, and it allows armies to grow in size because you simply get more men for your money. It's also worth saying that the pikemen themselves in the 17th and certainly by the start of the 18th century are going to be replaced by musketeers. And although they require more expensive equipment than the pikemen, the other points about the pikemen hold good for these musketeers in that they can be trained in a relatively short time. This man is holding a real lock. You may think it's very difficult to fire, and it is complex, but you can learn how to fire one of these and to be drilled in the maneuvers needed in something under a week. And this is partly because you don't need to be a skilled marksman to use a musket at all. It's interesting that in the English forces, the command that is given to the musketeers is not aim and fire, but level and fire. You simply levelled the gun and pointed it in the general direction of your opponents and fired it. So you don't need a stunning amount of training to become a musketeer. Any social, individual from any social group can become musketeers, and they're not inordinately expensive. So this. The first point I'm trying to make is that there's a change of technology towards pikemen and musketeers which displace the knights and actually allow a dramatic increase in the size of armies. The second point also relates to technology. What we've got here is one of the earliest pictures of supposedly ordnance or heavy artillery, and it's from a manuscript dated 1326, and it shows a knight just here. I'm going to come to terms with the technology here. Here's your knight. and he's going to fire this primitive cannon, which looks rather like a flower vase tipped on its side, and it's going to fire an arrow. And it's not surprising to me that this knight is sort of shrinking away like this, because it's pretty evident that as soon as he ignites the gunpowder, he's going to do himself some serious injury. So this early ordnance in the 14th century is pretty crude kind of stuff. But it did develop. Here's an English manuscript from the 15th century showing some mortars. You notice they're firing stone cannonballs at a fortification. So cannon do get better. And by the 16th century, you get something which is recognisable as the classic kind of cannon, with its long metal barrel, the mechanism, a carriage for transporting it, and wheels on the side. And this is an engraving by the well-known German artist Albrecht Dürer, and he probably did this engraving from what the cannon that he saw in the Emperor Maximilian's Waterloo Park. So by the early 16th century, the late 15th, the early 16th century, heavy cannon are much improved over what they had been 200 years earlier. Now, we shouldn't run away with the idea that these heavy cannon are all that great. They don't fire very quickly. If you got off 3, 4, maybe 5 rounds an hour, that's pretty good going. They're not accurate at all, and this makes them of very limited use on the battlefield, certainly until the 18th century. And they're also very slow to manoeuvre, and again, this limits their use on the battlefield. An English observer in the late 16th century says, cannon on the battlefield do little or no harm. One doth simply abase oneself upon the knee till the shot be passed. So you simply bent down and the shot just whizzed. You know, you're quite unlucky. In the 18th, particularly the late 18th century, they are going to become really important on the battlefield. But in the 16th and the early 17th century, they're not at that stage of development. However, what these cannon are good at are firing at targets that are large and can't run away and can't bend. And we're talking about medieval castles. And here, delightful picture of Conway Castle. And Conway Castle is very typical of medieval castles, which have dominated the landscape for several centuries. It has high, relatively thin walls. And the point about castles like this is that they are actually incredibly vulnerable to cannon fire. It doesn't matter that the cannon are slow to fire, the castle's not going anywhere. It doesn't really matter that the cannon are inaccurate, you just need to hit the wall generally in the same sort of area several times. And these medieval style castles prove very vulnerable to cannon fire. The stone out of which they're built shatters, the walls fall down, and you're able to make a breach. And this is demonstrated, it's often argued that it's the best demonstration of the use of heavy cannon is the campaigns of Charles VIII, French king, in the 1490s in Italy. In fact, he only uses his cannon when he goes into Italy once. It's the cannon is so effective that the other forts he comes upon actually surrender without waiting to be bombarded. But the best demonstration is in the 1480s and 1490s in Granada, in the south of the Iberian Peninsula. And the Catholic kings, Ferdinand and Isabella, use cannon to destroy the Islamic fortifications which have previously withstood sieges of months or even years. So really, within about a generation, medieval fortifications become obsolete against this new style cannon. And what happens is that, beginning in Italy, military architects begin to develop a new style of fortification which is resistant to cannon fire. And it's because of its place of origin, it's often called the Italian trace or the Tras Italienne. And the characteristics of this new style fortification are that the walls are not high, but relatively low and squat. They are not narrow, but they are immensely thick. And they are constructed not so much of stone, but of brick, of rubble, of earth and wood, the better to absorb cannon fire. And the other feature of these fortifications is that they have these projections, these triangular projections, which are called bastions, which are gun platforms, so that the defenders of the castle can fire out at the attackers. This is an idealized depiction by an Italian patriotto, but here is a real life image of these early modern fortifications. This is the city of Lucca, as it is nowadays in Italy. And what you can see, what you can see are the early modern walls which run around here. They're now covered in vegetation, and they are huge. They're so thick, so wide, that you have a major highway going across the top of them. And you can see that projecting out from these walls are these bastions. There's one, there's another. They go on and so on. So you get the development of this new style of fortification in response to the development of heavy cannon. What's this got to do with the size of men, number of men in armies? Well, simply this, that in order to garrison these new style fortifications, you need quite a lot of men. But in order to besiege them, because the best way to attack a fortification like this, it's very difficult to assault it directly. You can't cannonade it and hope to make a breach in the walls so easily. The best way to attack it and take it is by encircling it, so ringing it with a line of trenches and men, cutting it off from the outside world and starving it in surrender. But to do that, you need very large numbers of men. You can see from the size of the fortifications at Lucca that if you want to actually encircle this, you really do need many, many hundreds or even thousands of men. So this is the second reason, second technical reason, why there's this prodigious growth in the number of men under arms. The third reason, I can't really illustrate, but it's the most important of all, really. And it really has to do with finance. Quite simply, the rulers, the governments of early modern Europe, are just much richer than were their predecessors. And they choose to spend their wealth on war. And because they have more wealth, more resources, they can just raise bigger armies. Their wealth increases partly because of the demographic increase in the early modern period, also because of the expansion of the economy. Their wealth increases because they become more adept at extracting resources from their territories. So all this is important. But the whole thing is really kicked off early in the 16th century by the accession of the Emperor Charles V. And by a series of fortunate accidents of birth and marriage, he comes to inherit an empire that is as big as anything seen since the time of Charlemagne. So the Emperor Charles rules over the Spanish kingdoms, and apart from Portugal, he rules over large parts of Italy, including the Kingdom of Naples, the Duchy of Milan in the north. He rules over the Austrian Habsburg lands in the east, and he rules over Germany as the Emperor of Germany. And of course, he's also going to acquire territories in North Africa and overseas in the New World as well. So he... And I should also add that he's the ruler of the Low Countries, which is very important to him because it's very wealthy. He acquires most of these territories by dynastic succession, and a few he has to fight for. But the size of these territories just make him that much wealthier, give him that much more potential resource than all of his competitors. And he chooses to spend this on war, as he's obliged to do. And the other leading powers of Europe in the 16th century, notably Francis I, the ruler of France between 1514 and 47, are unwilling to allow Charles to dominate Europe, so they scrabble to match his expenditure. Henry VIII does something similar in England. And so what develops within Europe in the 16th century is something like an arms race between these great powers, which then continues into the 17th and into the 18th century. In the 16th century, it's really Spain that leads the way in pushing more and more into this arms race. In the 17th century, it tends to be Spain. By the 18th century, the Dutch, British, Prussia, and Austria are all joined in this arms race. But what I'm suggesting here is that it's the availability of resources together with interstate competition that really drives forward this growth in the size of the military. No state really feels that it can afford to drop behind in this arms race, because if you did, then that way could potentially lie disaster. So here we've got three reasons that I'd like to suggest for this very prodigious growth in the number of men under arms. Well, you might say, how do they find these soldiers? Where do they come from? How are they recruited? Well, there are three main mechanisms for finding these soldiers. Some are found by what we might call conscription, or what was largely called then impressment. Governments were prepared to force men to join armies, to conscript them or to impress them. And they would take into armies people who were deemed to be of little social value. So vagabonds, ne'er-do-wells, criminals might all be drafted. As you move into the 18th century and armies expand, governments tended to make greater use of impressment, particularly if they were governments that had supported armies that were large in proportion to the size and the wealth of the state. So somewhere like Prussia, which is a relatively poor state but maintains a large army, made extensive use of impressment, and it develops a system in the 1730s and 40s for identifying peasants and taking so many peasants into the army each year, albeit that many of these peasants would subsequently be allowed to a period of furlough from the army to go back and look after their land. So there is an increasing use of impressment. That's one way of getting men into armies. But it's not the favourite way, largely because governments often lacked the kind of administrative mechanisms for forcing people into armies. Also because recruits who were found in this way tended to take their criminal and licentious behaviour with them into the armies and become simply bad soldiers. And so you find that some of Elizabeth I's soldiers fighting in the Low Countries, when they send English recruits from the jails, send them back and saying, these men are just worse than useless. You can't give them anywhere to garrison. They immediately sell it out to the enemy. I mean, they're just hopeless. So army commanders are reluctant to take these people in. And this means that an overwhelming majority of soldiers are voluntary recruits. In the 17th century, the only state really which recruited the majority of its native soldiers by impressment was Sweden. But apart from that, no other state makes such very extensive use of it, impressment, until the French Revolutionary Wars, when in 1792 the French are going to declare what's called the levée en masse and oblige all citizens, male citizens, to serve in the forces. But until that, states recruit the majority, the overwhelming majority, of their soldiers as volunteers. And they have two main mechanisms for doing this. And you can see in this painting by Philips Vouverman, a Dutch painter, depiction what we think may be a recruiting officer. And here, in this case, a ruler, a king, would give a commission to a captain to recruit soldiers within the ruler's territory. And the captain would go out, he would have a drum, he would have a couple of men with him, a captain, a lieutenant, and so on. They would beat the drum, and they would get people to sign on. In return for signing on, there'd be a bounty. The level of that bounty depends on how desperate the government was to raise men, but that's how they would recruit them. Then the captain would take the men that he levied, and he would generally lead them off into the campaign, and he would command them in the campaign. So that's the first mechanism for raising recruits. It's by commissioned captains. The second mechanism, which is much neglected but is actually probably rather more important certainly in the early part of our period, is for a ruler to approach a military contractor and to hire a unit, a regiment, or even a whole army off the shelf. The ruler, the government, would go to one of these military contractors, and they might have standby agreements with them, as they did in the case of France with the Swiss pipeline, to say that in time of war, you'll come and fight for us and nobody else. They would say to these contractors, we would like you to supply X number of men. They have to be well trained, and they have to be of a certain kind. They must be expert pikemen, or they might be Albanian cavalrymen, or they might be German riflemen, or whatever. We need a certain number of men, certain number of regiments, and we'll pay you X amount of money to come and serve this particular campaign. So these private military contractors would produce the men, and these men would not be the property of the government. They would simply be hiring themselves out to the government. The system reached a peak in the 17th century, particularly during the period of the 30 Years' War, when huge numbers of men are raised in this way, and military contractors are prepared to make available not just small groups or even regiments of men, but whole armies. And the leading military contractor of the period is a man, a Bohemian called Albrecht Wallenstein, who produces an army which on paper numbered 150,000 men for service with the German Emperor. And moreover, not only did he provide an army, but he agreed to supply the army with food, to provision it, to see that it got its arms and equipment and its munitions, to see that it was paid, to see that the men were clothed. So what you're getting here is a whole army coming ready equipped and serviced as a by way of private contract. In return, Wallenstein and others like him, like Bernard of Saxe-Weimar or the Swedish General Banner and Torstensson, would be entitled to live off the land, to take taxes from the population. They would cream off taxes from the royal treasury, etc., etc. But they are prepared to offer these troops on credit, and that's one of their key virtues. And for governments which are strapped always for hard cash, to have a military contractor who says, yes, I'll come along, I'll fight for you, and it won't cost you anything up front, except a little bit, down payment, pay the rest in 6 months' time, years' time, so on and so forth. This is fighting war on credit. And if we think this is unusual, it's not. Think of how private military companies, the so-called PMCs, are engaged in Iraq, companies like Blackwater and so on. So this is a phenomenon which is not unique to the 20th century in the American army. It's something which really goes back to the early modern period. So there are three mechanisms for raising men: conscription, commission recruiting, and then these military contractors. You might say this is a little bit odd, because the majority of these troops are volunteers. And yet what we know about life in the armies is that it was actually awful. So why should anybody in their right mind volunteer for service in the armies? We know, for example, that pay in the armies is low, and often pay is not forthcoming and soldiers build up arrears, so that's no incentive really. We know too that, as well as the low pay, the fighting is pretty horrible. Warfare is often depicted as being consisting of battles with people charging about doing a great heroic chivalric deed, but it's not like that. Most of the fighting comprises not battles but sieges, and sieges are nasty, dirty affairs, as depicted by this German artist Schneers, who's shown us a plan of the siege of Freiburg in 1642-43. And what he shows is how the city there is being encircled by lines of trenches, and it depicts the men filing down to sit in these trenches. And the records of this siege at Freiburg, when you read them, make it sound very much like First World War combat, because the men are sitting in trenches, they're waterlogged, their feet go gangrenous, they lose toes, the enemy throws grenades and you get blown up, there are bits of bodies all over the place. They try and dig mines, tunnel underneath and plant mines to blow up the walls. The enemy combats this by countermining, blowing up people so you're suffocated underneath the ground. And it's really like reading an account similar to Birdsong, or the novel Birdsong, to read accounts of these sieges. So the fighting is actually pretty nasty. And although you can't see it very clearly in this painting, what Schneers depicts here is soldiers who are ragged, who are clearly careworn and find it don't look at all prosperous and are finding it very hard to make ends meet. So there's low pay, there's nasty fighting. We also know that the medical conditions are pretty appalling. Here's the frontispiece from one of the first a German manual called the Field Book the manual of wound treatment. And you can see what they're doing here is pretty barbaric. They're cutting off this man's leg with a saw. Now, the medical treatment available in armies is pretty appalling, unless you happen to be a noble when you took your own private doctor along. But most of the medics who accompany armies, and there are a few of them, have little training and are pretty poorly equipped to deal with the wounds. If you are hit in the body, you are likely to die. If you're hit by a musket ball or pierced by a pike or sword, simply because the wound is likely to become infected and there is no treatment for septicemia or gangrene, so you're likely to die. If you are wounded in the arm and the leg, you have a better chance of survival because the doctors did get better at amputation. The doctor who really is at the lead of this is a Frenchman called Ambroise Paré. In the 16th century, he was a physician to the king at one stage, Henry IV. But he discovers that the best way of cutting off limbs is not to do it with an axe, but to do it with a saw, for example, or a sharp knife, and that is some sort of improvement. He discovers, too, that you're better to seal off, to stop the blood flow, not by pouring boiling hot water oil on the wound, which is what they did, or cauterizing it with a hot iron, which generally killed the patient through shock, but by sewing it up and having the ligature. In the 16th century, they actually rediscover a whole series of medical treatments which were known to the Greeks and the Romans but had been forgotten. So doctors do get better at amputations, but quite honestly, medical conditions are still really appalling. People often or sometimes say, if you're at a party and they say, what do you do? You say, I do, I'm a historian. And they say, oh, really? What period would you have liked to have been born in? And I said, there's only two periods in history. There's the pre-anesthetic and there's the post-anesthetic. As long as I'm born in the post-anesthetic, that's all I care about. For these poor chaps, it's pre-anesthetic period. To add to the list of complaints, the enforcement of discipline could be very savage. This is an engraving by a chap from Lorraine called Jacques Callot. It's a series of engravings called The Miseries of War. And what he depicts is the very harsh punishment that soldiers underwent. In the centre is a punishment called the strappado, where soldiers are hoisted on a long pole with their arms tied behind their backs and held there in some agony for several hours. On the left-hand side is a punishment called riding the horse, where soldiers are forced to sit on a wooden horse, which is made of two planks of wood nailed together in a V shape, and their legs are then weighted down. And this clearly is very painful. And these are punishments in addition to the obvious ones of being shot or hung. And the list of crimes for which soldiers can be executed is just very, very lengthy indeed. Anything from mutiny, desertion, to going using the toilet in the wrong place. These all carry the death penalty. So discipline could be very harsh indeed. And there's quite a lot of evidence that during the course of the 17th and the 18th century, discipline really does become much more severe. So if you think about the life of the soldier, there's not much in it. And if the soldier is wounded and survives, as you see many ex-soldiers depicted by Callot have survived here, you'll notice the large number of people who have had limbs amputated. There's no kind of facility for their welfare. They're simply forced out onto the streets and obliged to beg, as these men are begging outside a hospital. The first major attempt to cater for ex-soldiers is the initiative of Louis XIV, the King of France, to establish this hospital, Les Invalides, at Paris. It housed only a few hundred men, so it's really not a complete answer, and most French soldiers never see the inside of the Invalides. They retire from the army and are forced to beg. And it's this, Les Invalides, which becomes the inspiration for Charles II to found his hospital at Chelsea in Britain. So, if you are to look at the soldier's life, it's undoubtedly a hard one. and yet most of them are volunteers. So you might say, why do people volunteer? Well, I think the answer is that most people have little alternative. And to understand this, we have to understand the overcrowded state of the labour market in the early modern period. There were always more people available than there were jobs. And men run the risk of being laid off in times of economic slump. They were often laid off in the autumn or the winter when agricultural work dried up on the farms. What are they to do? Well, the best place to go is into the army or into the navy, because there is a little better to be had. Some go in for other reasons. Let me quote you the words of Sydenham Poyntz, who says, to be bound an apprentice, that life I deemed little better than a dog's life and base, and so I joined the army. So he's an instance of somebody who goes off looking for adventure to get away from a humdrum, tedious world. Others, I think, welcome the chance to enjoy what they see as the licentious behaviour that is meant to characterise the life of the soldier, what Erasmus terms the wicked life of the soldier, provided with its easy availability of recreational sex and violence, the opportunity for plunder attracts some. For others, I suppose there is a chance of glory. The Holy Roman Emperor Francis I in the 18th century noted that what the natives of Ireland even dislike for principle, they generally will perform through a desire for glory. So some people go into the army for reasons of glory. Yet most recruits, I think, agreed to serve the prosaic reason that they simply had no other way of earning a living. And it's need and necessity that drives men into armies. Even Sydenham Poyntz, who I mentioned just now, trying to escape the humdrum world of the apprentice, confessed that his real reason for enlisting was, my necessity forced me, my money being grown short, to take the means of a private soldier. And the impoverished recruit created by the Spanish playwright Calderón de la Barca summed up the situation for the overwhelming majority of volunteers. Only great need drives me to the war. I'd never go had I money in store. And I think that explains it for most people. We should, I think, though, draw a distinction between the rank and file and the officers, because the officers are comprised largely, overwhelmingly, of nobles. And for the nobility, military service is still part of their identity. And for them, military service is not a base, they're not necessarily driven to it, it's something which they feel they ought to do. And a whiff of military service stands any noble in good stead. Let's turn finally to look at some of the social, economic, and institutional impacts of these armies. What you've got here is a detail from a painting by a Dutch artist, Sebastian Frans, showing a number of troops on campaign. Here's a similar, but a rather more revealing picture, again by this artist, Jacques Callot, showing a military camp. And what's noticeable about Callot's depiction are the large number of civilians that accompany the army. And very often we know that the number of fighting soldiers would be outnumbered by the number of civilians who traipsed around with the armies. Wives, hangers-on, sutlers, butchers, jugglers, people who deal in stolen goods, entertainers, harlots, prostitutes, wives, etc. Whole raft of civilians accompanying these soldiers. You can see here, Callot shows this butcher in the left-hand corner skinning an animal of some kind, and he goes on, I've enlarged part of it, there's a woman here who's depicted in labour in childbirth. So armies, we shouldn't think of them as being composed simply of fighting men, but of civilians as well. And these armies, which might be 10, 20, 30,000 field armies strong in the 16th and 17th century, maybe approaching 40 or 50,000 field armies by the 18th century, live largely off the land. And it is the direct impact of armies which most struck civilians. The fact that armies came into their area, extorted supplies, damaged property, burnt down houses and villages, terrorised the local inhabitants, led them off. And this is what impresses contemporaries. Here again we see Callow showing soldiers plundering a farmhouse. At the back there's a woman being attacked and molested. Here you have a civilian being tortured by being hung up in the fire and asked to confess where his gold and hidden treasure is. So this is the kind of picture that people have of how armies behave, and though exaggerated to some degree, it's largely true. They inflict enormous amounts of damage. Here's Callow again, showing a village being burnt to the ground, and here in the foreground you can see some of the villagers being led off, probably to work on fortifications or to dig latrines or trenches and so on. So the direct impact of war is what impresses contemporaries. And finally, a picture of what's called the Spanish Massacre. It's actually a propaganda piece, but this occurs in the context of the Dutch Revolt, where the Spanish massacre large numbers of civilians in the town of Udenwarte in 1575 and plunder it. With the benefit of hindsight, it's possible to say that these direct impacts of war are probably not quite as severe as contemporaries imagined at the time. One thing is that soldiers decimate the fields and they're often left barren for 6 months or a year. But leaving them fallow actually regenerates their fertility. So when they're tilled again, they're actually more productive. We know that many villages and towns which are burned or destroyed or partially burned or destroyed by soldiers are rebuilt very quickly, not least of all because they're made of wood rather than brick and stone. We know that many people who are thought to be civilians who are thought to be killed by soldiers simply moved away from the path of the army and then moved back again when the army had gone. So all this moderates the impact of war. We also know, I chose to illustrate this point by looking at Germany, that armies, even when we talk about Germany being in conflict or England being in conflict during the Civil Wars, what this tends to hide is the reality that armies actually tended to manoeuvre and operate within very limited localities. They're often drawn to the most prosperous areas. So that if you think about the English Civil Wars, the field armies of the Royalists and the Parliamentarians never go into the eastern counties, whereas somewhere like Berkshire suffers incredibly because it's extremely fiercely contested. If you look at this map, don't need to try and see it in detail, but it's a map of Germany during the 30 Years' War, and it shows the path taken by the Swedish King Gustavus Adolphus in his campaigns in Germany. And what you notice is he tends to stick to the rivers, he follows it down, he heads towards the Rhineland, where he thinks he'll be able to feed his troops, but look, there's huge areas of Germany where he never goes at all. And this is a reality for most conflicts in this period. So what I'm making a point here to say simply that with the benefit of hindsight, historians can say that the impact of war, the direct impact of war, was not as serious as contemporaries thought it was. It's rather like, I know, saying the Black Death was actually not such a bad thing because the peasants didn't all do well as long as they survived. It's not much comfort if you're in one of these war zones and caught up, but you know, there's the historian's view of the impact of war. Conversely, of course, the indirect effects of war are much more significant, I think, in a whole number of ways. The indirect effects of war arise to a large extent from the fact that the costs of war escalated. Although I've talked about the ability of early modern rulers to mobilise their resources more effectively, none of them ever managed to pay for war and fund it properly. They were always running desperately to find more increasing revenues. And they do so in a whole number of ways. They increase taxes, for example. They invent new taxes. They increase the level of existing taxes. They invent new things like lotteries, lottery is not a new phenomenon of the 20th century. The Italians have thought of it in the 16th and the 17th century. They use credit to an extraordinary extent and sometimes are prepared to pay interest rates which even somebody like myself who has a Visa card would find eye-blinking. Charles V, admittedly for a very brief period, paid interest rates to Spanish bankers of 49%. Visa, eat your heart out. They also find that they can raise revenues through what is called venality. That is, they manage some of them, not all, the English monetary exception. They sell off offices in their judicial and financial and administrative apparatus. They allow these positions to become pieces of private property. So that if you were a judge, for example, in France in the 16th and 17th century, you could buy your office and it became your property. You could sell it, bequeath it, hand it on to somebody else. And it's a revenue raiser for the government. What the government then does is to create another office to duplicate the one they've sold, and perhaps then another office to duplicate the duplicate one which has also been sold. So venality is another way of raising them. So the rising costs of warfare mean that states are constantly trying to find new ways of raising money. The costs of war are accounted for partly by the huge infrastructure costs of building, say, these new style fortifications. Berwick-on-Tweed, where you've got one of these new Italian trace forts in northern England, is built by Elizabeth I. It costs her the equivalent of a whole year's revenue. I mean, they're enormously expensive. States which run navies have huge infrastructure and capital costs as well. But the biggest cost of all is pay. Pay for soldiers and sailors. That's the biggest cost of all. So what's the effect of this desperate attempt to find new and bigger sources of revenue? Well, one is revolt. The truth was that the higher taxes bear increasingly, inordinately, upon the ordinary peasant population, and it is the case that they find this unsustainable. And so these early modern states are often prey to quite violent disorder and revolt as peasants resist the tax collectors. In France, in the first half of the 17th century, there are approaching 500 separate tax revolts. So the idea that these early modern states, because they're military powerful, are quiet domestically is really the opposite of the case. They're often highly disturbed. Second effect is that it's possible for people to rise socially on the back of the rising cost of warfare. How? Well, governments sell offices, they create these venal offices, and to entice people to buy them, they will say that if you purchase an office, it will make you ennobled. If you pay enough in the France of Louis XIV and buy one of the offices called the Secretary to the King, you don't actually do any work, you don't simply do any typing or post any letters, it's just a purely honorific title, but it immediately ennobled you. Other offices you buy, and if they're held within the same family for three generations, then the holder becomes ennobled. So this is a mechanism whereby the wealthy, the well-to-do, can gain ennoblement, become noble. You could short-circuit this, you could simply purchase a patent of nobility, which monarchs also sell. James I, I forget how many it is, I think it's 232 knights that he makes on the morning of his coronation. They include, as a contemporary says, such a scum of men as it would make you sick to think of. But they're all paying money. They're all paying money. So the demand, the need of government for money forces them down this road of selling nobility, selling office. Here's an opportunity for social progression by the rich and the wealthy. Third, the costs of war promote constitutional change in many states. Local parliaments, what you should probably call estates, often resist the ruler in his attempts to raise extra taxes, to enhance existing taxes, to get more newer taxes, to put in place lotteries and so on. And this often leads to conflict between representative institutions and rulers. It used to be argued that the outcome of this tended to be the victory of rulers, and hence the emergence of what are often called absolutist monarchs, who rule without consent of parliament, who suppress representative institutions. There are instances of that, and I guess the most notable is Brandenburg-Prussia, where from the time of the great elector onwards in the 17th century through to Frederick the Great in the 18th century, the estates of the various parts of Brandenburg-Prussia are gradually suppressed as the ruler counters the opposition to that they put up to him raising more and more taxes by suppressing them. But equally, you can find examples of the opposite case happening, and you only have to think of England, where there is a civil war, which is brought about in part by the king's demand for more money to fight the Scots wars, in which the king loses, and you get the emergence of a much more constitutional government. You could find lots of examples like that in Württemberg, for example, in Germany and elsewhere in Germany. If you look at the case of France as well, the picture is quite a checkered one. France is characterised by having lots of local representative institutions in places like the Dauphiné, Normandy and Languedoc. In the Dauphiné, they resist the demands of Louis XIII for more money. They're suppressed. On the other hand, the estates in Languedoc actually manage to strike a bargain with the crown, and their powers are actually enhanced as a result of their bargaining with the crown for more money. So what I'm suggesting is not that war promotes the emergence of absolutist states, but that war promotes constitutional change of some kind. It often lies behind these constitutional struggles. Fourth, I want to suggest that the pecking order of states in the early modern period is also altered as a result of war. Look at the maps of Europe in 1500 and 1789, and what you notice as the most striking thing is that the smaller interstitial political units, which had survived quite happily through the late Middle Ages, places like the city, independent cities in Germany, Nuremberg, Augsburg, or the city-states in Italy, are really disappearing. They're swallowed up by their neighbours. You also see that even medium-sized states like Venice or Sweden or Denmark, which have been real powers in the late Middle Ages, and Sweden poses as a great power in the 17th century, really become sidelined. And increasingly, these small units are either absorbed by the bigger states, or they become their clients and exist really on the coattails of these bigger states. And Europe comes to be dominated by what are called the great powers. Austria, France, Britain, the Dutch for a time, Prussia. And these great powers are really defined by their ability to wage war over a long period, to fight attritional wars, to find the resources, the money and the men, to fight these long wars. It's not always the biggest states that do best. Germany, the Holy Roman Empire, is a big state, but it's not actually very efficient at raising revenue, so it never really counts as a major player. Whereas the Dutch, because although they're a small state, they're relatively rich, are able to mobilise their resources very effectively and can sustain themselves as a significant power, at least into the 18th century. But the key point really here is that Europe is becoming dominated by the great powers. And this is really a function of a state's ability to wage war effectively over the long term. The final point that I want to make, and I'm going to illustrate this, I realise I haven't shown a slide for a little while, is that the growing numbers of men in armies, the extended periods over which war is fought, the length of campaigns and so on, and the rising costs of war, all make war much more present to people in the early modern period. And also the development of copperplate engraving, the emergence of periodicals and newspapers tell people about war. So there is a much greater awareness of war. And this leads, I think, to a greater questioning of war. It's true that there are very few pacifists in early modern Europe. The only real pacifists are religious pacifists, and you get some of them emerging in Germany during the period of the Reformation. that although most people are not pacifists, there is a greater questioning of war. In the Middle Ages, there is a tendency to say, well, war is just part of nature, really. It's part of the natural process, or it's God's punishment for men's sins. But now there is a more questioning approach, led by people like Erasmus, who say, well, should we accept war? Should we take it for granted that there will be war? Should we take it for granted that kings have the right to declare war without consulting their population and so on? And to illustrate this greater questioning of war, I put up this wonderful painting by Rubens called The Consequences of War, and this is done in 1638. And Rubens, of course, had been an ambassador and was well versed in statecraft and had a good knowledge of what went on in the courts, and he had a good knowledge of the costs of war. Let me just very briefly read to you from what Rubens himself wrote about this picture, which is really a great anti-war statement. The principal figure, he says, is Mars, who has left the open temple of Janus, which in time of peace, according to Roman custom, remained closed, and rides forth with shield and blood-stained sword, threatening the people with great disaster. He pays little heed to Venus, his mistress, who, accompanied by her Cupids, strives with caresses and embraces to hold him back. From the other side, Mars is dragged forward by the fury Electra, with a torch in her hand. Nearby are monsters, personifying pestilence and famine, those inseparable partners of war. On the ground, turning her back, lies a woman, and you can see her down at the bottom there, with a broken lute, representing harmony, which is incompatible with the discord of war. There is also a mother with a child in her arms, indicating that fecundity, procreation, and charity are thwarted by war, which corrupts and destroys everything. In addition, one sees an architect thrown on his back with his instruments in his hand to show that that which in time of peace is constructed for the use and ornamentation of the city is held to the ground by the force of arms and falls in ruin. I believe, if I remember rightly, that you will find on the ground under the feet of Mars a book as well as a drawing on paper to imply that he treads underfoot all the arts and letters. And so he goes on. So he's really using a series of icons, allegories, which would be well understood by his audience, to say the consequences of war are not glory and triumph, but are often misery and disaster. So I think it's worth noting that the growing impact of war does create some questioning of the rightness, the validity of war. Yet we ought not to go too far, and I'll just show you, finally, three slides to imply why we shouldn't take this argument too far. Here's Charles V, painted by Titian, showing him at the Battle of Mulberg. He was at the Battle of Mulberg, but he was carried round because he had gout, and so he couldn't ride his horse. But that's not the point. For Titian, he portrays Charles V as this great warrior king on horseback. For kings, for the nobility, this criticism of war really is like water off a duck's back. For them, it is the business still of kings to wage war, to acquire more territory, and to defend what they've got. So criticisms of war only go so far. And amongst the ruling elite, these criticisms don't get very much purchase. Here's this very well-known life-size portrait of Charles I, more inept military leader it would be hard to find, yet it's important to him that he's painted in the guise of a military leader. So again, military virtue, military glory is what Charles associates with monarchy. And here, of course, is the master of them all, Napoleon, crossing the Alps as he did in 1800, and Jacques-Louis David depicts him in this very powerful picture. Look at that horse, full of power and under the control of Napoleon, pointing forward the great war leader, taking his men over the Alps onwards to glory. It's a very, very powerful portrayal of a military leader. What we know, of course, is that in 1800, Napoleon did cross the Alps, but on the back of a mule covered in a grey army blanket. But that, of course, is not the reality that David wanted to show. So although war does have much greater impact, I think, in the early modern period, there is some more questioning of it. and there is some criticism of it, amongst the elites who generally officer the armies, who control the decisions about whether to make war or to make peace, these criticisms, I think, gain little purchase. And the slide you have all been waiting for. Yeah. Oh, thank you very much.